This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for January 2011. I'm Christian Wyman, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Don Scher, senior editor of the magazine. On the Poetry Magazine podcast, we feature poets reading their poems in the current issue and talk with one of our prose writers.
This month, we're going to hear from Mark Strand.
He was alive, living a secret life somewhere nearby.
And from Jennifer Chang.
Why can't lust be love and love be lust, you're always asking?
Then we're going to speak with the artist Madeline Averoff.
The words themselves and the poems are dimensional beings.
Also, in this issue, we have some visual poems by Joel Lipman. We've had him in the issue before, and these are very striking, hard for us to talk about on the podcast, but we encourage readers to seek them out in print or online. We have a poem by David Harsant. We have poems by Ray Armantrout, wonderfully astringent poems. One of the poems I really liked was one called Easter by Jill Alexander Esbaum, who's been in our pages before. You expect with a poem called Easter, especially written by a religious poet. Jill is a religious poet. At least I think she would think of herself in those terms. You'd expect it to be a celebration, and this poem is not exactly. Easter is my season of defeat. Though all is green and death is done, I feel alone. As if the stone rolled off from the head of the tomb is lodged in the door frame of my room. And everyone I've ever loved lives happily just past my able reach. And each time Jesus rises, I'm reminded of this marble fact. They are not coming back. It seems to me a wonderful poem because it at once posits the miracles of Easter and denies them.
But it denies them with a kind of astringency that's very compelling. When you see the poem on the page, it is very thin and column-like, which is a little bit like the marble fact of they're not coming back. So when you see it, it's very austere. And the rhymes sort of push you through. There are these couplets. The stanzas are just little bitty couplets that push on ahead through those rhymes like alone and stone sort of moves forward into tomb and door frame
and room
and, room and everyone. So the rhyme is actually very clever and poignant as well.
It reminds me, though the poems have little else to do with each other, of an early poem by Galway Connell called Freedom, New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an elegy to his brother. And at the end, he talks about how everything is reborn. And it's the old familiar conceit that you find in poems. But then the beauty and integrity of the poem is at the end, where he says an incarnation is an incarnation in particular flesh. And those who know this will know this man will know it until they die, that particular incarnation will never be back. And that's what this poem is about.
It really is. You know, the other poem that just kind of has to come to mind is Easter 1916,
right,
where those guys are not coming back, the sort of heroic names listed in that poem. And again, because of the austerity of Jill Alexander Esbaum's work, it's almost like she's pared away all that kind of public resonance and symbolic speaking that Yeats does in his poem and carves that way back. Even the title of the poem is halved. It's just Easter. There's no date. It's all those people. They're not coming back. And in that sense, it's kind of strict, like Eliot, not realizing so many had died.
Yeah.
Well, a poem I liked in the issue was part of a suite of Franz Wright prose poems. And I'm not sure exactly what the circumstances were that led Franz Wright to composed these poems, but I think Franz Wright is, he's been suffering some health problems and has arrived at a very intense moment in his career, it seems to me, and a lot is at stake in these prose poems. The last one we have is called Home for Christmas, and it's not very long, but I won't read the whole thing. I'll just read the last part of it. My dusty toothbrush waits for me. Of this I feel quite sure. My teenage image in the dusty mirror waits. Only now I'm afraid I'll be forced to disturb the slow, fine snow of dust that's been coming down year after year on my blanket and hair, and put on my dust-covered clothes and walk without making a sound, trailing my eternal lunar footprints down the windless hall and down the stairs at last. It's not going to happen overnight, but one of these days I'll arrive. I will go down to sit with the Father, the elderly father, strictly speaking, of never really having been there. I will sit down and eat my bowl of dust like all the rest.
That's a powerful poem. You can't read it without thinking of James Wright, of course, Franz mm-hmm. Wright's father, and all of his poems about Ohio, where this is set.
Yeah, Zanesville. No one's home in Zanesville, Ohio, it says in an earlier part. Being home for Christmas is something we all think about in the wintertime.
Hopefully it's a little better.
a little better than that. Maybe a little less dust. But I suppose after spending a long time having to contend with the father's legacy, fame, and also absence.
I think what makes it work so well is that, in fact, the first thing you think of here is not his relationship with his father.
Mm-hmm.
I will go down to sit with the father.
The father.
Not my father.
Right.
The father. And the father of never really having been there. And these are things that, whatever your circumstances, you've got to have some familiarity with.
Mm-hmm.
There's some sort of disconnection between yourself and the self that you were mm-hmm. at the time. And this poem seems to me to get to the heart of it. And it has a kind of Old Testament authenticity and strictness to it there at the end, which I think keeps it from being, some people would say, oh my God, what a downer on
right.
Christmas, you know. But I think it's like from Ecclesiastes or the book of Job or Isaiah or something.
Yeah, dust like all the rest. Yeah. It's really, well, it's profound.
An individual slug carries both male and female organs, but even then, that was of no help. Each had to both give and receive.
Many of you may recognize the voice of Sir David Attenborough, the broadcaster who's been producing terrific BBC Nature programs for the last 50 years.
In 2005, he put out a series called Life in the Undergrowth, and short segments of it made their way onto YouTube. For example, the part about the spectacular mating life of the leopard slug.
The underside of a branch will do very nicely. The two start to circle one another more and more closely until they entwine.
Well, this is a family show, but let's just say that this YouTube video led to a poem by Jennifer Chang, even though she didn't see it herself. She only heard about it from someone else.
She said it was very beautiful and very ballet-like, and I remember taking that image and playing around with it.
The poem was written as a gift to a close female friend in honor of her recent engagement.
And also in honor of our friendship. And we never actually had the conversation, and we never actually even seen the slug porn video together on YouTube. But it's one of those friendships where even when you're not actually talking to each other, you can imagine, you have imaginary conversations with them.
Jennifer Chang is the author of The History of Anonymity. This is her first appearance in poetry. Here she is reading Conversation with Slugs and Sarah.
Up late watching slug porn, you confess you had a boyfriend who could spin you like that. Slug grace and slug ballet, we don't touch the topic of slime. And those eyes dangling from tentacle tips must be a kind of love or lust, sighting farther and nearer all at once. But are those eyes? Slug sublimity suggests love's a drag, touch that lingers and leaves a wet trail of memory. And what did we do before YouTube? Boob tube. Boobs we have none. Slugs, of course, don't care. Can't tell girl from boy, being, you know, hermaphrodites, and only want flesh to fly. Forget their infamous languor. Here's litheness in loving, buoyant miracles of want. One slug spiraling on the axis of another like a globe slapped by an insolent hand. Neither old nor young, we're familiar with sluggishness, too tired to explain why nothing makes us spin like that, a swirl, a pirouette, a gyre. It's either fucking or marriage, I say, saying more than I mean. Why can't lust be love and love be lust, you're always asking? Even now, as the slugs begin their sluggish withdrawal, each complete in love and lust, each mother and father to what they've made together, each alone, content and free.
I love the playfulness of this poem. You know, YouTube, boob-tube, boobs,
right.
We have none. Slugs, of course, don't care.
Well, and you feel like you're eavesdropping on this conversation.
Yeah.
You know, what are these women talking about over here? And who knew they were talking about slugs?
Right.
Hermaphrodites.
Yeah, there's a wonderful control of sound throughout this poem. It's sort of, I hesitate to use all the verbs that come to mind, but It slides from right. line to line.
Well, the stanzas are in couplets, and the couplets are very nicely intertwined, and the lines themselves have internal rhyme. It seems like a lot of people don't use that so much anymore. Not sure why that is. So, for instance, in the last stanza, you have in the first line, each mother and father to what they've made together. The rhymes wrap around each other or intertwine, which frees up the end words, too. So the last word of the poem is free. And if these women are talking about, you know, getting married or entangled in some way, I like how the poem sort of wryly ends on that word, which even in terms of its sound is liberating relative to what the other sounds of the poems are.
Well, it is a serious poem in the end. Mm-hmm. I mean, its topic is communion and togetherness and isolation.
Yeah, and how you navigate that and sort of how you're driven by your species to reckon with certain realities.
And how the slugs have perfected this.
Right? I'm glad somebody has. Right, yeah.
Finally, their strange balletic relationship comes to an end with a bump.
Mark Strand has been a large presence in American poetry for decades now, and we have five pieces by him in the January issue.
They're short prose pieces, and I suppose you could call them prose poems, but Strand himself doesn't call them poems. In any case, they're part of a book he started this past spring and is close to finishing.
I mean, this is a quick book for me. It usually takes me years, but then these are written in prose, so I feel a little easier writing them. I don't worry them to death the way I do my poems.
We asked why these short prose pieces were easier for him.
Well, I'm not worried about cadence or line length. I allow humor to enter into these a great deal more than I would my poems. I allow myself to be frivolous. I have a great deal more fun writing these.
You can understand why they're more fun for him when you hear what it took out of him to write his poems.
I'd get up in the morning when I was writing poems and suffer anxiety right away. God, I have to work on that poem. Am I ever going to get it finished? Is it ever going to come out right? And then there's that other poem that's not any good now. Will I ever get that one? And on, and ruin my sleep and ruin my days because I was just worrying about these goddamn poems.
To write these new poems, or prose pieces, I guess, Strand says he first came up with a list of titles, then started writing the pieces after them, usually without knowing where they'd go. We're going to hear three of these pieces. The first one is called The Minister of Culture Gets His Wish.
The Minister of Culture goes home after a grueling day at the office. He lies on his bed and tries to think of nothing. But nothing happens, or more precisely, does not happen. Nothing is elsewhere doing what nothing does, which is to expand the dark. But the minister is patient, and slowly things slip away. The walls of his house, the park across the street, his friends in the next town. He believes that nothing has finally come to him, and in its absent way is saying, "Darling, you know how much I've always wanted to please you, and now I have come, and what is more, I have come to stay."
Well, you know, there's sort of a Latin American feel to this one.
That's true.
And just to digress for a second, you know, earlier when he says they're not poems, because in these prose pieces he doesn't have to worry about cadence or line length, there's a lot of truth in that illuminates what really does make a prose poem, if we wanted to insist on calling them that. So the line lengths don't pose any technical thing here, but the cadence you can hear in his own reading, there is real cadence here. It's not just prose cadence. There is some real poetry going on here that's kind of freed up for him by the fact that these can be written in prose. And something prosaic about this is you get the Minister of Culture and he goes home after a grueling day at the office and he's trying to think of nothing. And sure enough, nothing is what happens to him. Nothing comes to him seductively. Yeah. And threateningly.
And it's funny, he's the Minister of Culture, of course. And so, you know, he gets sort of the essence or quintessence of art, you know, right. Given to him, or of modern art. You know, this idea of the void being mm-hmm. something we have to apprehend is everywhere in 20th century art. And actually, it's everywhere in Mark Strand's work.
Yeah. And in a sense, his preparation for culture means that he's able to perceive that moment when, if you're patient, because it says the minister is patient, that slowly things slip away, even the walls of your house. I mean, that is what culture will do if it's real, is it will sort of dissolve things for you and present you with visions and things.
That's a good point. And, you know, if you think this piece, you know, spells doom for the minister of culture, you might think again, because that comes a little bit later.
Another one I have the title for but haven't written yet is called The Minister of Culture on the Eve of His Execution.
Well, hopefully we can get that one in our pages, too, when it when it manages to get written. The next one we're going to hear didn't germinate from its title like the others. Mark Strand says he actually started it a long time ago.
It was much longer and more elaborate, and I never knew what to do with it. It hung around for years and years. And then I just simply wrote this.
This being the mysterious arrival of an unusual letter. Here it is.
It had been a long day at the office and a long ride back to the small apartment where I lived. When I got there, I flicked on the light and saw on the table an envelope with my name on it. Where was the clock? Where was the calendar? The handwriting was my father's, but he had been dead for 40 years. As one might in such a situation, I began to think that maybe, just maybe, he was alive, living his secret life somewhere nearby. How else to explain the envelope? To steady myself, I sat down, opened it, and pulled out the letter. "Dear son," was the way it began. "Dear son," and then nothing.
Oh, I love this poem. I find it very striking and haunting, and you know, in a way, it shows you what a prose poem can do. Actually,
yeah.
It's somehow the fact that it's in prose, I don't know. It makes it more. What is it? It's more. It's quotidianness somehow. More in your face. You feel it more.
Yeah, and the transitions can be managed so perfectly. So the quotidian, you know, it's another long day at the office, like the poor minister of culture had. Long ride. Goes back home to a small apartment, and it seems so plain and forlorn and plaintive.
And then you get this Twilight Zone effect. Here's this letter, and this is all you're given.
Dear son, and then nothing.
It's inevitably reminiscent of that poem we read by Franz Wright.
Yeah. I think these are two poets who make this kind of thing sound or seem easy, but this is very, very tricky territory, very hard stuff to pull off. They leave you haunted. These don't end. There's something in your mind when you read them or hear them that picks up where these pieces leave off.
Yeah, and you get a whole, there's a novel packed into this.
Yeah.
You know, these couple of lines here, a couple of sentences.
Yeah, and you kind of wonder, maybe he'll get another letter. Maybe he'll never hear again.
The next one we're going to hear is called Futility in Key West.
Well, I was teaching Wallace Stevens, and I thought I'd throw Key West into one of these. Maybe futility has to do with the impossibility of my ever measuring up to the master in even the slightest way.
This piece does indeed refer to a few of Stevens' poems.
But it's also different. I mean, I wouldn't want someone to read this poem strictly against the example of Wallace Stevens. Futility in Key West. I was stretched out on the couch, about to doze off, when I imagined a small figure asleep on a couch identical to mine. "Wake up, little man. Wake up," I cried. "The one you're waiting for is rising from the sea, wrapped in spume, and soon will come ashore. Beneath her feet, the melancholy garden will turn bright green, and the breezes will be light as baby's breath. Wake up before this creature of the deep is gone, and everything goes blank as sleep." How hard I try to wake the little man. How hard he sleeps. and the one who rose from the sea, her moment gone. How hard she has become. How hard those burning eyes, that burning hair.
For me, what's striking about this poem is that when you see something called futility in Key West, you expect something very enervated, something very sort of filled with ennui. But this is a vigorous poem, that figure rising from the sea who's become hard. How hard she has become, how hard those burning eyes, that burning hair.
There's a line of poems from Key West, from Wallace Stevens to there's Donald Justice, and they are filled with the kind of lassitude. It's romanticism, the last gasp, you know, into lassitude. And this is romanticism grown hard. You know, it's like the hard gem-like flame.
Yeah.
Pater, it's...
Exactly. It's got some of Stevens' sort of fanciful stuff happening, but it takes a completely different path. So I think he's liberated himself brilliantly from Stevens here, if that's what he was after.
Every so often in the magazine, we do a feature called The View from Here, where people from various fields write about their experience of poetry.
In this issue, we have Daniel Handler, otherwise known as Lemony Snicket, the children's writer, neurologist Helen Fisher, musician Jolie Holland, and economist Stephen Ziliak.
And the artist Madeline Averov, who joins us by phone from her home near Los Angeles. Hi, Madeline.
Hello, Chris.
I wanted to start by asking you, you confess in your piece that, like a lot of people, you'd have a hard time getting out of bed. And what gets you up, and how does poetry help in that?
Well, probably the dog and the cats really get me up. That's where it starts. And I wake up mentally stressed, mentally strained. It's really the worst and the best time of the day for me. So I wake up with Kathleen Norris has rescued an old term called acedia, if I'm pronouncing it correctly.
Dante's term, right?
Yes, and it's from the 4th or 5th century from a monastic named Evagrius the Solitary, and he also called it the noonday demon. And I wake up with the noonday demon. The knowledge I wake up is if I don't get up, the day is somehow lost to me. Because once I do get up, it's the best time. Because it's quiet, and I can feel the presence of the world being alive early in the morning in a way that gets harder as the day goes on. Especially here, I can hear the freeway most of the time, which is an affliction for me. But in the morning, it's quietest. Poetry... Before I turn the light out, I always read in bed at night, and before I turn the light out, I'll pick out a line, and I'll run it through my head over and over and over again. And often I'll wake up with it. It's a way to link oneself with the other, because I felt since I was very young a kind of loss of soul at night, and I wake up a lot at night, and so there's a way to link the night self with the morning self. And poetry has helped me enormously with that.
Now, your morning self goes out on these walks in the mountains.
Yeah.
And there's a very lovely description in your essay about how you memorize poems when you're out on those walks. Can you describe that for us?
Sure, sure. Once it's light enough, I type out poems or I write them in longhand, and I fold them up and put them in my pocket. And I try to divide my time between being present to what's around me. So I will consciously, in a way, project out and bring the trees, or especially the trees around me, but often the sky, I'll bring them into kind of an internal psychic space, and then, I hope this makes sense, I pull the words in after. And then just as I do when I'm memorizing at any other time, I'll run one line or a fragment of a line or a few words over and over and over again. And then I try to silence my mind. It's an act of will. I try to silence the mind, to let birdsong come in, to let wind come in, to let, in that early, it's often very still. The thing that's very striking to me about being, I'm a Midwesterner, but just having been here for the last 5 years, there are many times there's no wind at all, which is very striking to me, and especially when I'm on the other side of the hill and I can't hear freeway, where I fall into that silence. So there's this kind of contrapuntal movement. I go out into the world, and then I come back in where the words are, all of which kind of weaves me together. And it really enables me to go back into my day, get my son out of bed, get him to school, and then go through the day as I have to go through the day.
Now, we reproduce in this issue, you're painting a mind of winter, and you talk in your piece about memorizing Wallace Stevens' poem, The Snowman.
Yeah.
You say that there are poems that, when they're uttered in good faith, concentrate the mind, becoming words with power, and as such, a cord, a laundry line, which I can follow hand over hand to the canyon of memory until I am Stevens' snowman. So how do you include these poems you're memorizing?
It's not conscious. I mean, I consciously will call up a certain poem, as I did this, the Stevens poem, so often when I was doing this painting. But I think because this has been my process for so long, that the words are persons. The words themselves in the poems are dimensional beings, and they do it for me. They are literally a bridge. And a word from Czesław Miłosz's poem, I think it's called On Prayer, and he talks about a velvet bridge from life to a kind of afterlife. And the bridge is a spontaneous creation. It's not something that I consciously conceived of. So there's a way in which I'm aware of kind of multiple existences in myself at the same time, which when I'm painting especially, the painting is more real than I am. Whether it's a landscape, whether it's a portrait, no matter what it is, I inhabit. My boundaries are constantly breaking down, and I inhabit whatever I happen to be making. And that's where I find a kind of joy that I don't find much in the world that's given to me, in the modern world as it's given to me.
Thanks so much for being with us today, Madeline.
Well, thank you both so much.
You can read Madeline Averov's essay and everything else you heard on this podcast in the January issue of the magazine or online at poetrymagazine.org.
Let us know what you thought of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is recorded by Ed Herman and produced by Curtis Fox Productions.
The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Don Scher.
And I'm Christian Wyman. Thanks for listening.